Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our guest co-host, Dr. Stephen Hooper. Welcome, Stephen.
Good to be here. Thank you.
On our show today, we're going to actually have a recent conversation with Dr. Nancy Burns, professor of sociology at Drake University, about the healing power of remembrance. Something that, as I get older, I think about more and more how one honors those who've come before us, how one remembers life experience in ways that can be healing, particularly when sometimes those memories are difficult.
Yes, I think the remembrance part is one that we probably take for granted, and trying to understand that process needs the type of work that she does.
Yeah, looking forward to having that conversation. But first, research that matters. Let's dive right in about our first one about post-traumatic stress disorder and how it may affect academic functioning. I must say, when I first saw this article, I thought it was about like academics in medicine or allied health. They weren't really going that far, but it could, right?
It could. In fact, one of the interesting things about PTSD is that you can have significant effects of that related to anxiety, emotion regulation, particularly sadness, guilt. We also know that from a number of studies in the military that PTSD can affect a very significant brain structure called the hippocampus, which is important for, at a minimum, our recall capabilities.
This is quite interesting, actually, even in light of our talk today with Dr. Burns about remembrance, because in this particular case, some of the memories are really stress-producing, and they cause dysfunction. And for members of our military who are veterans who've served but who may have PTSD, which could be very high percentages, they then are maybe back in school pursuing a degree or a master's degree, and those experiences can affect them in many adverse ways. This was research in the journal Psychological Trauma Theory, Research, Practice, and Policy, and really focusing one of the first times on what we might do to help veterans as they pursue their educational careers.
This is a real important area as somebody moves in that transitional phase from military to civilian life, they return to college, and indeed, it may not come as easily as folks may think simply because they may have a lot of baggage such as the post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, they were looking at 2,000 student service members and veterans, and they really found that for all the groups, this post-traumatic stress from their military service really led to greater family distress and lower social support from friends, and this led to higher academic dysfunction compared to those who didn't experience these events who were also in school. And I think it raises the question, if you know that those who have this are going to have difficulty in the school, perhaps you can intervene earlier by offering support services. I would imagine you and your work in allied health, you'd want to know if people are going to experience distress in their careers. Maybe we could identify it earlier.
We actually go after this proactively in our physician assistant studies program because half of those students are ex-military, and we are trying to track that from the very outset. So yes, it does.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, Steve, and it's about social isolation. What happens to the brain? What are the neurochemicals involved? And is there emerging research that could change this that might actually ultimately be a different treatment for things like depression? How do we link some of these things together? That's a tall order for one research.
It is, and I think the nice thing about this work is it's actually coming from the animal literature in a number of different species with mice and flies, and looking at a particular gene in terms of how might we go about attacking this. And again, as in previous shows, the issue of precision medicine raises its head.
This was in the journal Cell, very succinct name, and it's actually looking at a particular neurochemical called I want to say it right, tachykinin, and flies how this chemical promotes aggression and when it builds up. And can you then take one of the gene that's encoded upon it and do some work to then prevent the buildup in this enzyme, this neurochemical, so that in this case, the animals that were socially isolated don't have the negative effects, which we know are really tremendous, ranging from aggression to fear to all kinds of, you know, depression.
Again, in this study, actually, that gene goes after a particular organ in the brain called the amygdala. It's a social organ responsible for fear responses and aggressive responses. And by manipulating that gene, we're going to be able to perhaps see changes in those types of behaviors.
Yeah, this is a stay tuned sort of element. But if you hear about an enzyme called tachykinin, you'll say, I know, it's about social isolation and maybe there's something on the way. Speaking of on the way, we really are probably on the way with precision medicine as it relates to cancer treatments. We talked on a recent show about breast cancer, genetic testing, some precision medicine that may help women with kind of lower risk breast cancer not have to get chemotherapy. And this is about kind of where we're at and what we should be doing. This was research in the American Society of Clinical Oncology. What are they talking about?
This is probably one of the first studies to personalize medicine for very specific patients, and they're matching known tumor mutations to treatments. And at the end of the day, what they're trying to do is extend patients' lives and hopefully quality of life along the way.
And this was 3,700 people with cancer that was difficult to treat and had already done other types of treatments. So these patients would not have been expected to actually do real well. And then they looked at those that had a mutation and those who got treatment based upon knowing their genetic profile. And those who got treatment based upon this genetic profile were twice as likely to live 3 years compared to those who did not, though it wasn't very good. It was 15% compared to 7%. And they were much more likely to live 10 years. Again, not very high, though, overall 6% compared to just 1% who those who didn't. Now, this is not a randomized controlled trial, so there are other reasons other than the genetic testing that could be the reason why they lived longer. But it does say, we probably need to do a randomized controlled trial of this precision medicine for cancer testing.
One of the interesting cases in this group, though, was glioblastoma, which is a particularly aggressive and non-treatable form of brain cancer. And the fact is, they actually had good luck with that one person.
I think it's something worth asking your doctor about, your oncologist about, if you do have an aggressive form of cancer, and see. It may be of benefit. Our last research that matters affects me personally, so I got to talk about it, which is...
How did you dress today, Adam?
That's how did I dress today? Well, how did I dress today when I go to the clinic? And do my patients expect me to wear a white coat? And this is research that was in the British Medical Journal Open, a pretty prominent journal. And it surveyed a large number of patients over the age of 65, more than those who are younger. And, you know, wondering whether or not the patients preferred their doctors to be casual, be in scrubs with or without a white coat, to be formal with or without a white coat, or in business attire, no white coat. I can tell you, patients react differently depending on what I'm wearing. There's no doubt about that.
And how's that?
Well, when I come in with a business attire, my patients go, what are you doing today? You know, if I come in with a suit or a tie with a jacket but with no white coat, they always comment about it because I don't dress up that way that often. And usually I am doing something more formal. When I wear a white jacket, they don't say quite as much. I don't ever come in casual with jeans and tennis shoes. I bet they would say something. I hope they would.
We can make a little light of this, but the fact of the matter is this research does say that it seems to matter. And perhaps even more importantly, in our day and time of accountability and quality of patient perceptions of our care, this is one of the factors that gets rated. And so the dress may have an impact on how those folks rate the quality of care that they're getting.
Yeah, I definitely think we should talk about with our trainees about professionalism and our colleagues and let them know what this research is. Hopefully, this is just a small factor in satisfaction of care. Much greater is,
did you
listen? Did you give good care? Did you have a sense of humor? And did you get a better outcome?
the one top finding was they wanted you to was in a suit and in your white lab coat. That was the best one in this study.
Maybe they weren't down south in our suburbs.
And well, there was differences there, too.
That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be having our conversation with Dr. Nancy Burns, professor of sociology at Drake University, about the healing power of remembrance. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Nancy Burns, professor of sociology at Drake University, about the healing power of remembrance. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Burns.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you for having me on your show.
You know, it's really exciting to have someone who's a professor of sociology. I majored in sociology, but I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it, and you have actually showed me the path that I really could have taken.
Well, that's great. And I hear that from my students as well. They're not always sure, but it's a great foundation for people.
Well, and it was how I really got interested in medicine and healthcare. And I wonder, how did you become interested in the field of sociology and in the work that you're doing?
Sure. Well, my interest in writing about grief grew from both a professional and a personal reasons. So I was interested in sociology. In college, I wanted to study violence and crime. So I went forward with graduate work in those areas and was doing teaching and researching about victims of crime. And as part of that, was curious to learn more about how they coped with the loss and trauma that they experienced. In the midst of learning more about that, my husband and I suffered the loss of our first son who was stillborn. So then I wanted to continue to explore and learn about grief from a lot of different types of losses, and continue to write about that because I think it's so important to give people the courage to grieve and to know that it's okay to be grieving.
And I understand you also got your PhD in sociology studying and writing about domestic violence. What drove your attention?
I was interested in how media stories about domestic violence help us to understand the reason for abuse and then what we need to do about it. So one of the things that's a problem in our society is that we tend to blame victims of abuse and then also hold them responsible for getting out of the abusive situations. And so through that research, I wanted to encourage people to think about how can we better raise awareness about why abusers abuse and how we can educate people for raising people not to abuse and also to stand up to them.
Wow. It's interesting because I really got interested in a lot of the behavioral aspects of family medicine when I was a resident, and particularly around domestic violence and sexual violence. And it seems as if a lot of the patients that I was encountering, really the question of memory or remembrance was also tied up with the trauma of the remembrance. How do we understand this idea of memory being perhaps something that could be good, but for many people with violence, it's not so good?
Right. And I think one of the first things to always encourage people to remember is that grieving is an individual experience. So what may work for one person may not be helpful to someone else. So whenever I'm giving ideas or advice, I always want to preface it with that to know that ideas aren't going to be the same for everybody in terms of what's helpful. So we remember trauma not always because we want to, and then sometimes we remember what we lost because we do want to. So it's, I think, thinking about remembrance is both the question of do you want to remember, but also how do you remember? How do you carry those memories, and how do you carry that loss? And I think that's where understanding the importance of grieving and the importance of sharing can help us understand the way we learn to live with loss.
You know, it makes me think about the difference between my brother and I. Neither one of us met our grandfather on my father's side. He was murdered before either one of us was born, but yet my brother was named after him. And my brother's always had a different relationship with that remembrance of the grandfather who was murdered and trying to understand that better. So it seems as if we can each have a similar experience, but we interpret it very differently. Is that common?
Oh, very much so. And that's a great example of it. And I think for people in families, it's really important to understand that people grieve differently and their interest in how to remember and what to remember is going to vary. Because if we don't understand that people have those differences, then there can be a lot of conflict, and we might look at someone else's patterns of grieving and think, well, they're not doing it right, or maybe they don't care as much as I do because it looks different. Whereas that's not usually what's going on. It's that people need to be able to carry their loss differently and to express their feelings differently.
There's a difference between memory and remembering. How does that actually work?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think one of the things that's helpful in thinking about remembering with grieving is that you can be intentional about remembering if you are choosing to do so. And that can be on an individual level where you're taking some time to remember through writing or through looking at pictures, or maybe you want to set aside time as you're doing a volunteer project or some activity where it reminds you of that person that you're missing. And so that time of remembering can be healing and therapeutic. We also might seek out more formal rituals of remembering through community activities, such as memorial events. And that can be helpful because that provides us with a larger audience, other people who are sharing similar losses, or someone who might be able to listen to our stories. And those, again, are people seeking out intentional ways of remembering and thinking and keeping a social presence of a loved one there, even if they're not alive. Memory, we have memories, but these acts of remembering can also bring new stories. They can help us find new ways of carrying loss and trauma. So it can be a helpful way to do that. But not everybody is always ready for that, and that, I think that needs to be respected.
You know, it makes me think about, in the Jewish faith, we have the what's called our Yahrzeits, kind of celebrating or acknowledging the day someone passed year after year. And it is a way of remembering. And I wonder, what do we know about different faiths and how they approach remembrance? And what do we learn from those faiths?
Right. And that's a great example, Adam. A faith community that already has within their community structure times when people can remember loved ones who died. And that can be important because otherwise you're left having to create those opportunities on your own. So different faiths have a varying levels or varying times when they do that, right, depending on maybe at different holidays. Or even within the same religion, you might have individual congregations or cultural groups that choose to act out some of those more than others. And it can be things even as simple as during a holiday having a school or a church or a community group offering a chance to buy plants or buy memorial bricks in a sidewalk or things that you can honor a loved one, right? So it's the time when a community is coming together and it offers someone a very formal way to remember a loved one.
You know, I know we're going to take a break in a second, but I wonder before the break if you can just set us up to understand how is it different, this remembrance on an individual level that we've been talking about versus a societal level, because there's so much trauma that really affects society. Is there a difference between the two?
There is. I think when you reach the societal level of remembering, it becomes more complicated in terms of whose version of events are we remembering. So the politics of history and the politics of how we are constructing memorials or how we are framing events get involved in that. And the politics can very much then affect how people are grieving. They might feel left out. They might be angered. They might be affirmed in how would they believe it. So anytime you have larger groups of people involved, it can get a little bit messy in terms of how we remember.
We need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Nancy Burns, professor of sociology at Drake University, about the healing power of remembrance. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Nancy Burns, professor of sociology at Drake University, about the healing power of remembrance. Right before the break, Dr. Burns, you were distinguishing between what we might experience on an individual level and a societal level. And I wonder, when you get into things that were so traumatic on a societal level, maybe it's slavery, maybe it's racism, maybe it's the Holocaust or other genocide, how does that change what we experience or understand?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that we can look at the new opening that the Equal Justice Initiative, led by Brian Stevenson, what they're doing in trying to raise awareness about lynching. And that's a good example of opening conversations about the terror and the loss that the families of these lynching victims have been going through, but that they've had to do that in silence. And so now, through this formal way of remembering and a place where people can go and they can read about these stories and see about it and talk about it with others, acknowledging that loss can be an important step for some continued healing. And it can also help us in tackling these very difficult issues of racial discrimination by going back and looking how there's some historical roots there. So remembering these difficult things, and that they're also difficult to talk about in present day, are still going to be important for helping people to learn how to carry that trauma. So it's not that we can get rid of the traumatic past, but we can learn to carry it differently by having other people be honest and acknowledging it.
Yeah, I think it's what you say, and perhaps why you don't like the term closure, because we're continuing going to carry it with us.
That's right. And closure has so much baggage with it that it's become this term that people feel you have to have in order to move on. But it's closure is just this word that we have made up to talk about loss, but it's not the only way we can talk about it. And through my research, you know, I've come to see that closure is actually doing more harm than good for us in talking about it. Because closure rhetoric echoes this finality, and it sets up a distorted image that we might have of grief, which is grief should end, and it should end as quick as possible. And I don't think that's fair, because I think that grieving, not only does it come and go throughout our lifetimes, but it's also a helpful process. It hurts. Nobody wants to grieve, but it's important because it's a way of expressing that not everything's right here, and that I hurt, and that I still love. So if we can change that language and change people's expectations about grieving, I think that opens up more room and more space for people to grieve, which then gives them also more space to carry love and joy.
Yeah, and what a wonderful space and place to get to. You recently wrote about Holocaust Remembrance Day, and perhaps a similar way about this need to observe these days of remembering. And it makes me think of some conversations I've had with some colleagues recently about forgiveness. And it had to do with, for instance, would my Jewish friends buy a car made by German manufacturers? And in a global society, it might be easy to identify the car, but it may be more difficult to identify the bottle of wine or other things. And where does this place forgiveness as it relates to remembrance that is really something you carry with you your entire life?
Yeah, well, there's a lot packed into that question.
Thank you.
So I think, yeah, I think it's helpful to know that when we talk about forgiving someone or something, it's not the same as forgetting it. So sometimes there's that, you know, saying we'll forgive and forget, but that's not a helpful way to think about that. So we can forgive, but still carry it. And forgiving can provide a new way of carrying the pain, though. And it's a very individual process. How long it might take someone to forgive varies. Whether or not they can forgive one day and be really kind of okay with that, or do they forgive almost every day? That it's more of a process rather than a one-time event. So just as grieving is individual, forgiveness is as well. And sometimes people get to the point of forgiveness because they've tried to carry their pain in so many other ways, and they realize that they can't do that, and that they become a little bit more open to thinking about forgiveness. Or forgiveness might be connected to their faith and to the narrative that their faith has for them. So we see the reasons why people forgive in a lot of ways. And to the question of, so can someone who is Jewish buy things that are German, that's also, I think, going to vary by how they define the German experience. So some people might see some of the progress that has been made in terms of forgiveness on the part of German society and connect it to that, whereas others connect it more to the past. And I don't know that we need to be trying to tell people how to do that, but rather offering opportunities for them to think through that and talk about it and understand how those products or how those memories are connected to their own pain.
I wonder to what extent is it, though, culturally different in different societies, or is this a universal sort of experience?
I do think it varies. Anytime that we have specific cultural ideas about how to remember or what to remember, that is going to affect the references that we have for how to approach events. And so in the United States, one of the dominant narratives about grieving is that you should be not grieving very long, right? And then people assume that also might mean you shouldn't talk about the people who died after so long, because if you do, then that might mean something's wrong with you. So I can give you an example. In one of my interviews for my research, I had a woman who I was talking to her 5 years after her son died, and her son was in his 20s when he died. And she was telling me about him, and then she started to cry. And she said, you know, what is wrong with me that I'm still sad 5 years later? And I said that, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. You know, this makes sense that you would still be sad. You know, she's doing fine, and she has a very vibrant life, but she misses her son. She also wants to talk about him because he was funny. He had great stories, and she wants to share those stories. But she was conflicted because she was in a culture that made her feel like if she kept talking about her son who was no longer alive, then that meant something was wrong with her. So there are other cultures where that's not as strong of a narrative, and people don't feel as much guilt when they're talking or remembering their loved ones.
I was recently up in New York City, and I was able to go to the 9/11 Museum. And I was so impressed with how, even though I didn't personally know someone who died in 9/11, walking through that museum, they individualized almost everyone's narrative to such an extent that I felt connected. And I wonder how important it is to be connected through stories.
Right. It's very important. It's hard for us to understand the human toll that trauma and war and, you know, other acts of violence take on us without the stories. We can read the numbers, and those are important to help us grasp the scope of an event, but it's through the stories that help us understand just what people have lost or what we have lost as a community. It's also through stories that we can be connected in our humanity with each other, and I think that that is part of why grieving is so important. We don't want to shut down people's stories, but we want to hear them, and that also helps us stay connected with each other.
Well, that's really powerful. Well, let me ask one final question as we wrap up. Are there any other thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with about this healthy way of understanding remembrance?
Sure. I would encourage people to understand that it's okay to grieve And that, as I mentioned already, that might look differently for everyone. But grieving is all right. It's important. And even though the grieving might feel like it lasts a long time and, in fact, can come and go throughout our lives, we grieve because we still love. And we remember because we love. And if we can listen to each other, to not underestimate the power of listening, it can sometimes be hard to find good listeners. And so listen to each other. And I think we're going to learn a lot about grief and remembrance and just open up those opportunities for people.
Well, we certainly want to let you know how much we appreciate on behalf of your health, helping us to learn and listen to your words. I love the remembering because we love, and that'll stay with me. So thank you.
Thank you, Adam.
We've been talking with Dr. Nancy Burns, professor at Drake University of Sociology, about the healing power of remembrance. We're going to take a short break, and then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. For the House Call segment of our show today, Laura, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listeners' health questions and concerns, and they can also send us their own questions that they'd like us to address on an upcoming show to yourhealth@unc.edu. What's our very first house call today?
My husband's been going to see his doctor for more than a decade, managing blood pressure and diabetes. I've noticed over the last 3 months that he seems to be having some episodes of forgetfulness, and I'm worried about Alzheimer's. How do I mention this to his doctor without making my husband angry?
Well, first off, I appreciate that question because we all have family members or friends or others who this could apply to, right?
Sure, yeah.
I mean, the high blood pressure and diabetes alone has so many people in the United States. And then memory loss. And, you know, first off, how are these two things connected? Well, those two conditions and certain others like smoking can cause little small kind of narrowings of the blood vessels of the brain that can look like Alzheimer's. They can be like mini strokes. It's not really Alzheimer's, but it can cause some memory loss that looks like that. It's real common. An MRI or a CAT scan will show it. We call it white vessel disease or small vessel disease, changes in the brain that look like, not like Alzheimer's, but it can be some memory loss.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you can do about it if that is the case?
Well, unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do other than trying to keep the diabetes under control, keep the blood pressure under good control, maybe diagnose it so that we are aware, because it's not like Alzheimer's. It won't necessarily get worse quickly.
Okay.
But it may get worse over time. I think showing up when your loved one is at the doctor and letting your loved one know you want to bring some things up in front of the doctor in a respectful way, that's probably better than everyone kind of wanting to talk about it, but no one really wanting to talk about it.
Yeah, I think communication might be key here between this listener and their husband and the physician.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that the spouse here is wanting to bring this up. Sometimes you could maybe send something to the doctor. The doctor may not be able to respond, but can say thank you for sharing that information.
Right.
And I'll try to figure out a nice way that I could bring that up in a respectful way and encourage conversation, because it may not be easy. And no one wants to be told your memory's not what it was, but your memory could be great for what happened 20 years ago, but it might not be so great for what happened yesterday.
Is it common for family members to come talk to a physician?
Happens all the time, and we encourage it, because otherwise, who really would know that it's changing? The doctor, you know, may not really know, because you may be talking about things you talked about 10 and 20 years ago and having that conversation. Then all of a sudden you realize they don't know what they had for breakfast earlier today.
And family members see that much more easily.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that house call. What's our very next one?
My mother has fatty liver disease and has been getting really sick. Her doctors say she gets confused when her ammonia levels build up. Is this common, and what can we do about it?
Well, unfortunately, it's a lot more common than we may have thought 10 and 20 years ago. When I was in training, I just didn't get much education on non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. We got lots of education about alcoholic liver disease, but increasingly, a lot of patients don't drink alcohol, but yet they have liver changes that are very similar to alcohol. and it can destroy the liver. So it can be very destructive and cause cirrhosis or scarring of the liver. And then what happens when that scarring happens is things that normally are cleared through the liver, like ammonia, build up. And you can imagine, ammonia is not great to smell. It's not great to be around. And what would happen if it would build up in your system? Well, it causes what is called encephalopathy. That does not sound good, does it?
None of this sounds good.
And it's not really good because that really causes people to be really confused. They can fall. They could really die if it doesn't get treated. The good news is that most times it can be treated, but you have to take a medicine that causes your ammonia level to lower. And frequently that's actually by taking medicines that cause you to have more frequent bowel movements, sometimes loose bowel movements. So a lot of people say, I wouldn't want to do that.
Right.
But the choice between having this ammonia level build up to very toxic levels versus having it controlled and living many more years,
right,
which is what one might be able to do. So it's really important to get that ammonia level checked, to follow up with either a liver specialist or your primary care physician, and then get on these medicines that can lower that ammonia level if indeed you had that toxic amount of ammonia in your bloodstream.
Is this something that, talking about liver disease related to alcoholism, is that something that is a conversation that happens a lot in that kind of liver disease as well, or is it more particular to this fatty liver disease?
No, that's a great question, Laura. And once people actually develop this cirrhosis, it would act very similarly. However, if one had the fatty liver not from alcohol, and then one were to drink, it might make it even worse.
Okay.
So we tell people, if you weren't drinking, you certainly don't want to start. And if you were drinking, you do need to stop.
Right.
But the treatment for it is actually quite similar. And there's not a whole lot of dietary approaches, at least for the ammonia level. You just need to see your doctor regularly, get it checked, and get on the right medicine. Usually if you're having 2 to 4 bowel movements a day that are moderately loose, you won't get the buildup of the ammonia. If you have no bowel movements a day, it might build up within 2 or 3 days.
Oh, wow. So you really have to stay on top of it.
You really have to stay on top of it here. You might have to check it more regularly.
Right.
What's our very last house call?
I've been getting a medicine called Teslon for chronic cough for a decade. When my doctor retired, my new doctor said that they don't like this medicine as there's no evidence that it works. They don't want to prescribe it to me, but I really feel like it helps me. What are your thoughts?
What's interesting is physicians use this drug pretty frequently. They kind of call it Tylenol for the lung. It seems to have a local anesthetic numbing effect on the lungs that may be different than, let's say, an opiate.
Okay.
Like Hicodin or some other syrups that have opiates in them that suppress the cough. It's not an opiate, so in that respect, people think of it perhaps as safer, and it generally is. However, Teslon can have some significant side effects.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It can cause people to be confused. It can cause burning sensation. It can cause other side effects. Most people don't have them. It can be really toxic to children if they drink it or inhale it or take even one tablet. It could cause significant problems. So you have to really keep it away from children. And the reality is there's not much data out there. I mean, there's very little data that's actually ever been done showing that it really does provide benefit.
Okay.
But I hear stories just like our listener. And for some people who maybe have tried the over-the-counter regular things with dextromethorphan, DM, doesn't seem to work for some people, can work for other people. It may be a reasonable alternative, but perhaps not your first-line treatment.
Right. Well, and this, it sounds like this person has a chronic cough that, you know, I've only taken it short-term when I have a cough that just kind of won't go away, bronchitis or whatever, but I've never really thought about taking it long-term. Is that a problem too? Is that maybe
I'm not crazy about that. I think it's a great point. And in general, we should try to figure out what the cause of the chronic cough is. Are you having chronic reflux of acid that's going into the lungs? And if we don't solve that problem, you're going to get scarring of the lungs. Do you have scarring of the lungs? And that may require further workup. So I'd really like to work with our colleagues in ear, nose, and throat, our colleagues in pulmonary medicine, our colleagues maybe in gastrointestinal medicine, come up with a plan that may work. Great questions today. And we want to thank all of our listeners today for joining us on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. And Laura, they can send a question to yourhealth@unc.edu. They can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Nancy Burns. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health, on behalf of Your Health. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.